This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 18, 2003. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Iraqis are readying for war. As Baghdad stages military parades, local gun sales rise, and foreigners arrive in Iraq as so-called human shields. 200 veterans of the Southern Civil Rights Movement file an amicus brief in support of UMichigan's affirmative action policies. And we continue our special series looking at oil around the world. Today, part two of oil in Colombia. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Prime Minister of Turkey said today that Turkish and U.S. officials must first agree on the specifics of the U.S. deployment to Iraq's northern neighbor before their parliament can vote on any plan that would allow tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers entry. President Bush said today he's confident good friend Turkey will do the right thing.
We've got great respect for the Turkish government. We had no better friend than the American government, and hopefully we can come up with an agreement that's satisfactory to both parties. We're still working it.
With more than 90% of the Muslim nation's population against supporting a U.S.-led war against Iraq, the Turkish leaders are hoping a larger amount of money from the West will make the deal palatable to the public. Today, the United Nations Security Council began a debate on Iraq open to all UN member countries, as France pledged to veto an early resolution authorizing war. From the United Nations, Susan Wood reports.
Today's meeting was requested by South Africa, which chairs the non-aligned movement of 115 mostly third world nations. It will give non-council members a chance to state their views on Friday's reports to the Security Council by the UN's chief weapons inspectors, Hans Blix and Mohamed El Baradei. Those reports said Iraq was showing signs of increased cooperation. Many of today's speakers are expected to support the call for continued weapons inspections endorsed this weekend by the European Union, which also called on Iraq to disarm. The U.S. and Britain are planning to circulate late tomorrow a new resolution authorizing war against Iraq. But the prospects for passage appear dim. French President Jacques Chirac said yesterday France would have no choice but to veto such a resolution at this time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Shell Petroleum lost an appeal in their attempt to end a breach of contract suit by two firearms companies. Sam Olakoya has more from Lagos.
The firearms companies said they had two valid agreements with Shell for the supply of arms and ammunition worth about $1.5 million for the company's use in Nigeria. Since the case was instituted in 1995, Shell has made several attempts to stop it, saying the Lagos court has no jurisdiction to hear the case. It is believed that the weapons were meant for the Nigerian military for use against civilians opposed to Shell's operations. In less than 10 years, the Nigerian military has killed more than 4,000 people in the Niger Delta in the course of quelling local agitation against the operations of Western oil companies. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
The University of Michigan has the support of some of the United States' best-known former generals and the controversial battle over its affirmative action policies. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
Former Army Undersecretary Joseph R. Reeder announced that the assembled military brass will file a joint brief in support of affirmative action. Reeder called such programs, quote, essential to our fighting force, and noted that the service academies and ROTC programs rely on affirmative action to form a diverse officer corps. Among the two dozen retired generals supporting the Michigan program are three former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs, as well as General Norman Schwarzkopf, General Anthony Zinni, and former defense secretaries William Perry and William Cohen. The brief is one of more than 60 expected to be filed in support of Michigan's affirmative action admissions policy. Many big businesses, including General Motors, Microsoft, and Procter & Gamble, have broken ranks with President Bush and come out in support of affirmative action. The case will be argued before the Supreme Court on April 1st. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The Florida Attorney General is investigating sports giant Nike for alleged price fixing. WMNF's Mitch Perry has more.
A Nike spokesman says the shoe company received a notice of civil investigation last month in regards to issues of price of products at retail. The Beaverton, Oregon corporation denies the allegations and says they are fully cooperating with the Florida Attorney General's office. Florida Attorney General Charlie Crist reportedly asked major sporting goods retailers in Florida whether Nike withheld items because its marquee shoes weren't being sold at the prices the company considered suitable. The probe comes amid an intensifying battle between Nike and Foot Locker, its biggest U.S. customer. Last December, Nike said it would stop shipments of such shoes as Air Jordans and Shocks this month because Foot Locker decided to give more shelf space to shoes that cost less than $120. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush confirmed today that the U.S. is drafting a new U.N. resolution on Iraq, though the president also insisted that U.N. backing was not necessary for a U.S.-led war. Bush also said he was not deterred by the millions worldwide who took to the streets this past weekend to protest his administration's push for war. Meanwhile, as Jeremy Scahill reports from Baghdad, Iraqis are readying themselves for the almost inevitable military incursion.
While Washington continues to face stiff opposition to its war plan, Baghdad is focusing its attention inward and at foreign news cameras. The government has been staging large military parades in cities across Iraq. The events are meant to reinforce the message to America and ordinary Iraqis that there will be stiff resistance to any attempted invasion. There are the suicide bombers dressed in Hezbollah-type garb, complete with fake sticks of dynamite strapped to their chests. There are members of the Al-Quds Army, originally formed to liberate Jerusalem, with pictures of Saddam Hussein pinned to their uniforms. Some of the forces look like something out of a World War I movie. Others, clearly, are not in top physical shape. There are women's battalions, Kurdish militias. At times, the parades look like a children's Halloween procession. Indeed, there are children's divisions. The faces of some of the men tell a sad tale of a tired people. At the parade grounds, people present themselves, eager to repeat the line given constantly to foreign journalists.
May I introduce myself? My name is Jailan Mahmoud Hussein Al-Jabouri. I am a student at the University of Tikrit, College of Science, Deep of Biology. From this place, we want to express our feeling that we are refuse any intrusion of American, and we want to tell them that we are soldiers of our President Saddam Hussein, and we want to tell them that we are our country is strong, and we can cut them to small pieces. Thank you very much.
Privately, many ordinary Iraqis say they are not enthusiastic about fighting America. Iraqis are survivors, and most are primarily concerned with protecting their children and their families. While many people say they would reject a foreign occupation, they say they would fight only if their family was being directly threatened. At a military parade in Mosul, one of the marchers showed us a picture of his naked 5-year-old son, Jassim, born with a severe birth defect. The actual forces that will likely resist a U.S. invasion are not the ones on display at these marches. The Special Republican Guard units, the Fedayi Saddam or Saddam Militia, controlled by the president's son, Uday. In years past, Saddam Hussein was the guest of honor at such parades, but he's not appeared in public for years. Instead, the red-mustached vice chairman of the Revolutionary Command Council, Izzet Ibrahim, sits atop a balcony saluting the forces as they pass through the parade grounds.
The Iraqi government has been hosting military parades like this throughout the country over the past several weeks as the Bush administration continues its push toward war. But today is special. This parade is taking place in the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, Tikrit. The governor of Tikrit has just said that the soldiers have finished their preparations for war, that they're ready to fight America, and that victory will be Iraq's.
The men marching in the parades are not the powerful forces of the pre-Gulf War Iraqi military. Their guns are empty of ammunition clips, and their march is a bit out of step.
Citizen in Iraq.
Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party has been distributing weapons to its members. They're organizing citizens' militias in areas around Iraq. Gun shop owners like this Baghdad merchant also report an increase in gun sales. Picking up a rifle in his store, he tells us, "This is an American gun. I hope we can kill them with their own guns." He says Iraqis are searching everywhere for any kind of gun to face the American invasion. He says the Americans will see something they have never seen before. "We are not Afghanistan," he says. "We're willing to fight for generations. Let them come," he says. "Let them come. We will take revenge for the Palestinians and the Arabs. Where are they? Let them come." Baghdad's strongest and most loyal forces are not parading in cities across Iraq. Those forces are training for urban warfare against America, and they'll likely be seen only when Saddam Hussein needs them to be. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
As hundreds of thousands of Americans continue to take to the streets, sign petitions, and lobby their representatives to try to avert a war, a relatively small but increasing number are going to Iraq. These peace activists hope to call attention to the plight of the Iraqi people and put a human face on those who are likely to suffer most should a war begin. Nigel Middleton takes a look at this growing movement of peace activists ready to make the ultimate sacrifice as human shields.
I've had some extremely fearful moments in the last month, but in every case, you know, if I go to bed afraid, I wake up in the morning and my courage has overtaken my fear.
Mena Jo Green of the Hudson Valley Peace Brigade, hours before her departure for Baghdad last week.
I remain committed because this is a pivotal point in history for the United States. And I realized with this impending war that it was going to take more than prayers. It was going to take each American to go as far as their courage will allow them to just say no to this horrific plan that will not succeed in either liberating the Iraqi people or making the American people safer.
Green is not only risking her life, but also criminal and civil penalties, ranging up to 12 years in prison and $1 million in fines. Thus far, the U.S. government has threatened and sometimes imposed fines in the tens of thousands of dollars. In any case, Green has a large community supporting her violation of the embargo against Iraq. Organizers of the Hudson Valley Peace Brigade say that most of the $11,000 raised to send Green and two other women came in small contributions from members of their local community. Claire Evans of the Chicago-based Christian Peacemaker Teams has been organizing trips to Iraq since last fall. She says part of a delegate's mission is to get their local community invested in the trip through the financial and moral support it provides.
We ask that each delegate have a support community of some kind at home. For many of these people, it's in their church or their local peace group, and media contacts, which would help disseminate the word about the person's going both before he or she goes and while they're on the trip and when they come home. To us, spreading the word in the home community is extremely important, and how the grassroots people feel about the war can affect whether it happens or not.
Both the Hudson Valley Peace Brigade and the Christian Peacemaker Teams are going to Iraq under the auspices of Voices in the Wilderness, a group that has been traveling to Iraq for over 7 years to draw attention to the effects of the sanctions. These organizations, and others like them, select and send only small numbers of delegates to Iraq in order to document life there and give a voice to a people they say has been ignored by mainstream media. They reject the label human shields. Other organizations embrace the term and provide mainly logistical support to anyone who wants to go to Iraq. They believe it is crucial to get large numbers of Westerners in Iraq.
My goal has been and will continue to be 10,000 plus people. If we do that, we make it politically impossible for this war to go forward.
Ken Nichols O'Keefe, former U.S. Marine and founder of the Truth, Justice, Peace Action.
We must do something more than just simply protest. We've got to stop this war, and I would argue that the best way to stop this war is to get Western lives down into Iraq, because the sad and tragic reality of our world is that we value Western life far more than we value any other form of life on this planet.
A double-decker bus convoy of human shields that crossed Europe has just reached Iraq, and O'Keefe says several hundred more volunteers are expected in the coming week. Most of them come from countries where O'Keefe has drawn the most media attention, namely European countries, Canada, and Australia. There is no official count of the number of American peace activists in Iraq, but American organizations such as the King Gandhi Peace Brigade and BecomeTheChange.org say that in the coming weeks, as American troops continue to be deployed near Iraq, they hope to send peace brigades of several hundred people. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nadja Middleton.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandes. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. As we reported in the headlines today, more than 300 organizations representing academia, major corporations, labor unions, and nearly 30 of the nation's top former military and civilian defense officials filed briefs supporting the University of Michigan's affirmative action policies that the Bush administration is opposing before the Supreme Court. Also filing an amicus brief today are 200 veterans of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. Former chairman of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, Lawrence Guillot.
What 205 veterans of the civil rights movement, including Coretta Scott King, relatives of Vernon Dahmer, Martin Luther King, Schwerner, Goodman, and 200 other people involved in Freedom Summer and in SNCC and the fight for to desegregate America, is calling upon the Supreme Court to not turn back the clock. We don't want the legal profession to resume its former status as virtually an all-white preserve. We find it significant that the business community has joined with us, not has filed an amicus curiae brief also. We feel that this country has moved too far ahead to retrogress at this time.
Lawrence Guillot, what's at stake here?
What's at stake is what kind of country we're going to have. What's going to be the definition of citizenship? We feel that in America there should be one definition of citizenship. Isn't it ironic that there was a black justice of the Supreme Court replacing another black justice of the Supreme Court? So how can that Supreme Court say that somehow we should completely obliterate all considerations of race? You cannot deal with the racial polarization in America unless race is one of the ingredients in the equation to do so.
Former chairman of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, Lawrence Guillot. For generations, Washington, D.C. has been a nexus of civil rights organizing. In the early 30s, a successful boycott of a popular hot dog stand that refused to hire African Americans led to the creation of 300 new jobs in 2 years. Fearful of a massive boycott of its stores, the sanitary grocery company, now known as Safeway, took the group of Howard University law professors, civil rights activists like Mary McLeod Bethune, and common citizens all the way to the Supreme Court. In 1938, the court ruled in favor of the activists and set the legal precedent for the use of picketing and boycotts that we all enjoy today. Ingrid Drake reports on a new chapter of the civil rights movement taking place in Washington, D.C.
No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation.
The world-famous musical group Sweet Honey in the Rock is one of many groups that have taken up the cause of democracy for Washington, D.C. Yet most people in the world are unaware the 600,000-plus people who live in D.C. have no voting members of Congress. And unlike U.S. territories Guam and Puerto Rico, district residents pay federal income taxes and serve disproportionately in the military. Bill Moseley from the group Stand Up for Democracy explains how congresspeople from as far away as Florida and Texas can overturn local ballot initiatives and rework the city budget.
Because our budget has to be sent to Congress for approval before the city can put into effect, it gives Congress the opportunity to put riders on our budget as a condition for it passing, such as not allowing city-funded needle exchange to prevent AIDS. This literally kills people. Not allowing the use of marijuana for medical purposes, which was approved by the district voters overwhelmingly in a citizen initiative. So it allows Congress to, it gives them a vehicle, really, for forcing their agenda on us against our will. This year, the D.C. budget was held up for over 3 months past the end of the fiscal year. We had no budget for about a fourth of the year.
Not surprisingly, this injustice has spawned activism dating back to the turn of the century. Many D.C. residents commonly refer to D.C. as the last American plantation and have resisted the federal government's efforts to meddle in the affairs of the majority African-American city. Anise Jenkins, also from Stand Up for Democracy, recounts one example of D.C. residents' successful struggle for self-government.
Stand Up for Democracy started in 1997 in opposition to the move by Senator Larch Faircloth from North Carolina, who actually had a bloodless coup in Washington, D.C. He took over the government, left Marion Barry, who he detested, and he decided that D.C. was not going to be run by Marion Barry. It was going to be run basically by the Congress and by him. He left the mayor with Parks and Recreation, and Stand Up for Democracy sent people down to North Carolina, sent Larch Faircloth down to defeat, and we're still in the movement for full democracy for D.C.
Timothy Cooper from the advocacy group Democracy First came up with the idea for the D.C. primary to become first in the nation. Timothy has also testified before the United Nations and the Organization of American States about D.C.'s inferior status. He sees the primary as a next step in the movement for democracy.
The opinion about to be handed down by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which will classify the status of D.C. residents as a human rights violation, with the presidential primary, presumably to be held first in the nation in Washington, D.C. With these two initiatives linked and occurring contemporaneously, we will now be able to elevate the issue of our disenfranchisement not only at the highest levels of national dialogue, but also within the international human rights world.
Lawrence Guyot, a D.C. resident who was a 1960s Freedom Summer volunteer in Mississippi, believes ending the disenfranchisement of D.C. is just another chapter in the civil rights movement.
In Mississippi, we fought for the right to vote. We were not allowed to vote, so we had to conduct our own elections. We challenged the congressional delegation. We challenged the Democratic Party's rigid policy of segregation in Atlantic City in 1964. And the Democratic Party said very clearly there would never be another segregated delegation. Right now, the issue is disenfranchisement.
We want voting representation. We want voting representation.
This is Ingrid Drake reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
Thanks to Mark David Richards for his invaluable research assistance.
Colombia's oil-rich state of Arauca is called the Eye of the Hurricane for all of its violence. Since the beginning of this year, it's endured attacks that have toppled two electric towers, exploded four car bombs, implemented four successful pipeline strikes, and killed at least 64 people. The reason the guerrillas, the paramilitaries, and the army have waged war in this region is in large part because of oil. Colombia's second largest pipeline begins in Arauca's Caño Limón complex, and the pipeline, co-owned by Occidental Petroleum Corporation of Los Angeles and the state oil company Ecopetrol, has triggered a wider U.S. involvement in Colombia's 39-year civil war and marks an important shift from previous U.S. policy of providing military aid almost exclusively for anti-narcotics operations. Occidental has lobbied the U.S. military for more assistance. But it was only last year that the Bush administration agreed to train, arm, and provide air support to protect the pipeline as part of a campaign to secure oil resources and help win the war against the leftist insurgency. In the second of this two-part special report, Nicole Carson takes a look at the oil-rich, war-torn state.
From the window of a helicopter flying over Arauca, the Caño Limón oil complex is the most prominent structure among vast plains and small villages that blend into the riverbed of the Arauca River, dividing Colombia from Venezuela. Army tanks are stationed inside the territory, which is demarcated by military checkpoints, and aside from the actual complex, it is an expansive tract of land. The 18th Brigade uses its helicopter pad for logistical purposes, and a small group of U.S. Special Forces are stationed here as well. Oscar Garcia, Arauca's president of the Oil Workers Union, the USO, says that accidental petroleum has contributed to the development of the war. He says that the militarization of the Caño Limón complex endangers oil workers, making them a target for the guerrilla.
Pequeñas bases militares dentro de las estaciones. Eso que hace que los trabajadores convivan permanentemente con el ejército.
The small military bases within the complex force the workers to permanently coexist with the army. Unfortunately, the army has been declared a military objective by the insurgency. We've denounced this, but the company is not interested in preserving the integrity of its workers.
In December, a bus of Caño Limón workers was bombed and two were killed. Human rights defenders in Arauca say that Occidental Petroleum has a dubious history of involvement in violations surrounding the Caño Limón complex. Last March, a 17-year-old campesino, Horacio Hurtado, was killed at Caño Limón by soldiers from the 18th Brigade. In September, under the state of emergency, President Uribe decreed three municipalities in Arauca as rehabilitation zones, granting the military special powers. Human rights defenders proclaim that the zones violate many constitutional guarantees. Hector Gonzalez, a human rights worker in Arauca, says that the rehabilitation zones coincide with the pipeline's path.
Hoy la fuerza pública en Colombia y específicamente en Arauca no está para garantizar la vida y honra y los bienes de los ciudadanos.
Oil is the motivation in all three municipalities. Arauca, Arucita, and Saravena are where the Caño Limón Covenas pipeline passes. It is not difficult to detect that this is to protect multinational interests. The other rehabilitation zone is in the states of Bolivar and Sucre, where the same pipeline also passes.
Arauca's oil has fueled and financed Colombia's conflict for almost 20 years. Until recently, the National Liberation Army maintained political control of Arauca state government and extorted the oil royalties to finance the guerrilla army. Numerous critics in Arauca and Bogota have said that throughout its years of operation, Occidental Petroleum has paid off both the guerrilla and the paramilitaries to keep its oil running. Currently, campesinos in Arauca denounce that the paramilitaries are attacking their villages and forcing campesinos to flee so that the territory is open for oil exploration. Pedro Galinda, one of Colombia's leading oil experts, asks whether Occidental is really removed from the conflict.
Who runs Arauca? The guerrilla or the government? And how do the economic interests of Occidental play in that? There has never been a declaration from British Petroleum or Occidental that they clearly condemn the paramilitaries. Never, not one. And one asks, how is it that you've never condemned them?
In 1998, three U.S. civilian airmen reportedly marked the target as Colombian military pilots, searching for FARC rebels, dropped U.S.-made cluster bombs on the Arauca village of Santo Domingo, killing 18 residents. Responsibility for the Santo Domingo massacre has not yet been determined in Colombian courts. FBI investigators verified that it was a U.S.-made cluster bomb, and in January, the State Department decertified the Colombian Air Force Brigade involved in this incident, restricting their military aid. One Colombian Air Force pilot has said his orders came from Caño Limón. Representatives of Occidental Petroleum refused to comment on the incident. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nicole Carson in Arauca, Colombia.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.